The Guardian.
Hello all, James Richardson here, and before we get started with today's edition of Football Weekly, I'm going to point you in the direction of our sponsor Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show. Football Weekly, battle rages high above the Premier League. Top guns currently Maverick Leicester, while toppling gunners are Chelsea. Iceman Arsen shot down by Goose. All goes pear-shaped once again for Wenger. He's under fire for withdrawing Giroud. He says you can't have polls for every decision. And after Fabianski and Wojciech, can you blame him? Elsewhere, Saints defeat Red Devils, ensure more purgatory for their supporters. Is that it for the great Louis Kablooey? Liverpool survived just a 9-goal thriller at Carrow Road. Terrific spectacle and broken spectacles. And goal of the season. But was it Dele Alli's at Palace or Di Maria's in Paris? We look at other bits from the continent and talk Charlton too in this Football Weekly. Hey, it's Monday morning and here we are in Podland. It just has that feel that there's going to be some breaking news today. Breaking news that we at this moment are as yet unaware of, as I sit here surveying the faces of Paul McInnes.
Hi,
just back from the game.
Well, it was a couple of days ago.
Yeah. But, you know, in your mind, I bet you're still absorbing. Did it really happen? Was I there?
I'm still furious.
Furious. We'll be talking about that very, very soon, Paul. Paolo Mandini's here.
Hello.
Didn't get much sleep because you've been doing NFL football.
I've been doing double duty on NFL and Serie A.
Wow. What did you get up to this weekend, Barry Glendening?
I had a comparatively quiet and peaceful weekend.
All right. Yeah. Here's to quiet and peacefulness. Here's to producer Ben as well, whose birthday is coming up at the end of this week, so he's having the day off. Producer Pete's in for him, while Ben is having a special day with a special lunch and also a special wrestling session with John Ashton.
On a hearthrug, women in love style.
That's correct. That is correct. Anyway, listen, let's talk about the football, because there's ever so much to talk about. Arsenal-Chelsea. Once again, Arsenal-Chelsea. Did you know that 21% of Chelsea's points, apparently, this season have come against Arsenal? I bet you knew about them 9.5 hours they haven't managed to score.
Yeah, certainly did. Knew about the fact that Arsenal have played 180 minutes against Chelsea this season and played, I think, about 115, 116 of those with 10 men or fewer. So right. It's been...
Is that all somebody else's fault, do you think? Or do the Gunners bear some responsibility?
It's not my fault. So it's definitely somebody else's fault. Mm. Probably, in this case, you'd say it's Per Metsaker's fault for making a rash challenge on the edge of his box. Although not blameless with the midfielders who allowed Willian to play that pass in the first place. He was put in a position which was a difficult one to judge as a defender. You don't want to go 1-0 down early in a game like that. And if you think you can make that challenge, you maybe take the risk on it. But
right. Keith Daly asks, if you're making that challenge, do you look across at the linesman while you're doing it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I know that's something that has been picked up on afterwards. And yeah, look, he didn't judge it right and it was a mistake. And it was a mistake. And it's one of those, unlike what happened at Stamford Bridge, it's one of those where you sort of don't completely want to tear him out for it, because he is a defender in a very difficult position trying to make it a judgment call in a snap second. And I'm sure, given the opportunity again, he wouldn't do it, but it is a very difficult position he's been put in.
Well, it all went pear-shaped once again. And Arsene Wenger, in his wisdom, then decided that the best thing to do was take off Olivier Giroud. Giroud didn't seem entirely of the same opinion.
No, he didn't. And there's a few things that go into this. He was... apparently picked up a knock in training and there was some doubt of whether he was going to last 90 minutes. So I guess that factors into the decision. I think that there's also a framing here that we do retrospectively, in as much as they scored very quickly afterwards, Chelsea. And I think that if they don't, then this decision makes more sense, because what you're saying is, well, okay, we can't presume to take the initiative in this match at the moment, but what we can do is allow ourselves to absorb and keep the option of Theo Walcott on the break, the option of Mesut Ozil on the break, the option of keeping your faster players on the pitch to do that. The problem is once you've gone a goal behind, then suddenly it does look rather foolish not to have the guy who scored 9 goals in 10 games at Emirates, up front and have that option. So yeah, there is that. There's different ways of spinning this, but I do think that if they hadn't conceded the goal so quickly, and if Theo Walcott hadn't gone on to have such an absolutely dreadful afternoon, it might have looked like a less foolish decision.
Theo Walcott did have 2 clear-cut chances in the first half alone to draw it 1-1 and singularly fluffed it.
Mm. As for Flamini,
that was kind of like a dojo behaviour, wasn't it? It's like,
oh, I see, right, yeah. But, I thought it was balletic.
No, yeah. Ballet has a bit more elegance than that.
All right, then. Well, first shot on target for Arsenal, say the stats, was after 85 minutes, a flick from Flamini.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, that could... you know, you could look at that and think there were no chances, which there were. I mean, actually, the ones that Paul just referenced, at least one of them, I think possibly even both of them, he was offside for Walker because he kept timing his runs just wrong. But there were, you know, there was the goalmouth scramble in which Koscielny managed to knock the ball away from Courtois, and there are a couple of players who could have followed in on it and didn't manage to get clean connections on it. So it wasn't for want of any chances in the game that Arsenal failed to score. But yeah, there wasn't a ruthlessness with those chances that did come up at all.
Right, the kind of ruthlessness that Diego Costa exhibited
absolutely
when he pounced on that ball about 5 minutes after Mertesacker had made the long walk.
And it's funny, isn't it, with Chelsea, just how after such a, you know, prolonged period of bad form that they still have the collective muscle memory to play possession football at 1-0 up and just close that game out effectively.
A Chelsea team that's on the longest unbeaten run in the Premier League now.
That's right.
And rising.
Three wins, four draws.
Exactly. Which take them up to a whopping 13th. So now only 14 points off the top four.
And I think the thing is about relegation teams like Chelsea, it's like they can raise their game for the big matches.
Right.
It's
they have to beat the teams around them.
That's the thing.
Right. Teams around them like Everton, we'll be talking about them very, very soon. Wow. Cesc Fabregas had a good game.
Very impressive. Probably the best player on the field, I thought.
Good.
Yeah.
But that, it's interesting, you know, for him and Costa as well. There was a moment where Costa kind of put on the sort of afterburners, cutting into the Arsenal box in the first half and took a guy about 3 yards and did him in a sprint. Both him and Fabregas looked a lot more limber than they have done for a long time.
Fabregas said his brain is quicker. His brain is quicker now under Hiddink.
He also looks like he's lost a bit of weight as well.
Right. A rival publication this morning has a picture of Flamini in the headline, "Oh no, we've blown it." What are the repercussions for Arsenal and the fabled title bid?
Well, I think it's probably slightly overstating it to say blown it when you're 3 points off the top and there's still 15 games left to go. 2 points from the three games they've just played is bad. You know, that was not how that was supposed to go. I think that the home game against Chelsea was a real opportunity, in the same way as when you're 3-2 up against Liverpool is a real opportunity to state yourself as something more serious than you've been in past years as a title contender. But, you know, the fact is that this is still a weird season. It's still a season in which that top of the table picture is not clear. City obviously dropped points again at the weekend. It's, you know, it's not at all... I wouldn't say it's at all blown yet. The problem for Arsenal is they've still got a lot of tough away games coming up in this next run, and unless they're going to start pulling out these results in these games, then they will blow it.
Right. Well, let's talk about those other teams up there and around them, in and around Arsenal at the top of the table. 3 points clear of them, indeed. Leicester, who widely believed to have been finished, their bubble having gone pop all over the place, but who want Stoke, fearsome Stoke, 3-0. Mahrez back doing his business, Vardy back on the score sheet, and N'Golo Kante tearing it up in midfield. He leads the league in both tackles and interceptions. He's a busy lad.
Yeah, he's been very impressive. I fully expected Stoke to win this game, but their away form is excellent. And Leicester have been through a rocky patch, and it's quite telling that they've been through this not a slump, but, you know, where results haven't been going well for them, and they're still 3 points clear at the top of the table.
Yeah.
They've got tricky fixtures coming up, though, and if they can negotiate them, then I think we all need to sit down and have a meeting about the very real prospect of them winning the Premier League.
Right. Well, even the prospect of them being in the Champions League next season.
No, why not win the league?
No. What are the conclusions? But that whole notion of them being in the top four at the end of the season is now looking like a mathematical extreme probability.
Well, this is a point Stuart James pulled up on our. The Guardian's website earlier was the last team.
Only one team has ever had this many points and not finished in the top four, which is
Aston Villa in 2008-09. I think what was interesting in what he mentions here is that he says that with the same points from 23 games, they were fourth and only 5 points above fifth place, whereas Leicester are first and 10 points, and that shows the season we're having.
Right, but Rahul asking, are Leicester actually any good, or is the Premier League just poor?
I think there's definitely, I don't think it's at all fair to say that the league is poor. I think there's definitely a lack of the standout clubs we've had in past seasons where there have been one or two teams who are running away with everything. I think it probably speaks to a higher quality in teams such as Leicester and perhaps a slight dip in the teams at the very top.
I don't think there's an absence of quality. I think there's just an absence of consistency.
Yeah. Right. They're 10 points clear of the team in fifth, Man United, of whom more anon. Oh, that's a big margin for them to you know, dissipate.
Yeah. And I think the point about the Villa side, I remember that Villa side, it was the Martin O'Neill team, and they were so incredibly reliant on Milner, Downing, Young every week to deliver something.
And it's not like Leicester rely on a couple of...
Well, no, but what we're seeing with Leicester right now is, you know, that Danny Drinkwater goal was an absolute cracker. Mm. And, you know, as you say, Kante is, you know, he was running that midfield, driving it to the extent that the pressure was coming off Mahrez a little bit.
Right.
Okazaki's been in great form these last few games. Ulloa scores his second goal of the season, taking some of that pressure off Vardy.
Who was the last team to go from that kind of greater distance away and make it into the Champions League?
You think Liverpool?
But they're a club at least with some kind of muscle memory, as you say, of how to behave in Europe's top club competition. I'm just wondering how Leicester would do, what the precedents are for, you know, going in at the deep end like that.
Are you talking about all over Europe, or it's probably like Batty Borisov or someone like that?
In the Premier League, it's probably Everton under Moyes, isn't it? Yeah. Where he started with them, they were relegation contenders, and after a while, and then as soon as they got to their Champions League qualification, they placed, was it Villarreal, the qualifiers, and they just got schooled.
I feel like, you know, that's certainly been true of Italian teams as well, when teams like Udinese snatched that last Champions League berth, never seems to end well for them. I think that definitely there's a big difference between finishing third and fourth that people still tend not to think about at the end of the year when they're celebrating and being in the top four. I think it's a huge difference being in the group stage, because that buys you the extra time to get your pre-season sorted out, and it buys you the extra time to be in your stride by the time you're getting into those group games. So that can affect our perceptions of it. But look, I mean, I think we're still probably putting the cart a bit before the horse, but I will say that I think I was scoffed at when I said, when we were here over Christmas, I said that I thought Leicester would be in the top four, and I said it then, and I still think they will. I think, why what do we see about this team that makes us think they wouldn't be in the top four at the end of the season?
At Christmas, I was in that same pod, and I said Manchester United would definitely come back into the top four and take Leicester's place.
Do you know what? You might be proved right, Paul.
Might be, yeah. Long 15 games yet.
We might be ramming that bit of ramming back down your throat.
Maybe.
Reverse ramming.
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope so, eh? That'd be fun. I mean, let's hope not, because everybody wants to see Leicester do well. You know what I mean. Man City, Barry. They drew at West Ham. So much to enjoy in this game. Dimitri Payet. Oh, he's amazing. All those little drag backs and... Oh, fantastic. Oh, Sergio Aguero. He's doing well, isn't he? Another couple of goals. And Sam Byram.
Yeah, he played well. Manchester City, sort of, as is the propensity for all these, you know, big name teams who you'd expect to be putting on serious challenges or leading the table, indeed, instead of Leicester, have shown remarkable propensity to shoot themselves in the foot on a repeated basis, which sort of gives me kind of grounds for optimism that Leicester could actually pull it off.
Mm. So this was Man City's fault, was it? You're thinking of like Otamendi's defending?
Well, Otamendi's defending was atrocious. Di Michaelis didn't have a good game either. And I think with the two of them in the heart of the City defence, you know, they're just prone to so many errors. Also, I believe Vincent Kompany has had another setback, which means he may be out for longer than was originally planned. He's a huge loss for City. But yeah, West Ham were impressive and well worth their point.
I think it's also, you could say that on the day, Kayate and Song, you know, were stronger than Delph and Toure in the middle. And there was particularly one moment where there was a foot race between Kayate and Toure, who was just left looking like he was in the world's strongest man competition pulling a bus.
Right.
You know,
with a fridge on his back.
Yeah. So I think
was Jimbo visible on the sidelines?
Right. He was visible on the sidelines. Oh, yeah. Right. But I was on mescaline at the time, so maybe there was something. But I think that is a problem for City that's been noted, that, you know, Toure is very, very important to them, but they can't quite find the right place to accommodate him in the team.
Wow. But well done, West Ham, eh?
Joe Hart as well. He pulled off a sensational save.
On that Payet free kick. Mm. It was nice to see the pair of them congratulating each other as they made their way down the tunnel. Mm-hmm. That's it for part one. We're going to head down our own metaphorical tunnel. Oh dear, I don't like how this is heading. but anyway, we'll be back after this.
Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Part two begins with a very special game. Paul McKinnon is with his cardigan on, feet up by the fire, and his pipe in his mouth, and he's saying, I was there that day when Norwich lost 5-4. But actually, which day do you mean? Was it the time when they lost 5-4 against Southampton back in April 1994? Or was it the time that they got done 3-0 by Bournemouth? Or was it the time that they got done three goals? They basically conceded goals. I mean, every weekend this happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I mean, I know it's very difficult, but at least tonight I'll be able to go to the cinema and relax and watch a film and kind of take the pressure off.
Ooh, what film are you going to go and see? Oh,
needless. You don't need to know, mate. It's fine. Anyway,
listeners, he's getting lucky chap's going to go and see Hail Caesar, which is about 2 months before it actually comes out.
Yeah, and the guy is blaming me because I invited him and he got the day wrong and now he can't come. So anyway, and that's why he's trying to wind me up about all these bad Norwich performances.
But I'll tell you about this
bad Norwich performance.
Yeah, come on, let's hear about it.
Because I was incandescent with rage for about 6 hours after, like, really borderline.
You were 3-1 up, can I remind you?
And we were playing well, man. We were actually playing well. We looked reasonably well organised at the back at that point, and we had some great attacking plays. Naismith and Houlihan were on the same wavelength immediately, and Bakani scored that cheeky back heel. We were putting them under pressure, and they didn't look like they had the confidence to come back. And then at 3-1, I think it was only a couple of minutes between 3-1 and 3-2, but in that moment after that goal, we just decided, as we sometimes do, hey, that's it, we've won that game, we've done enough now, that was enough, put in a bit of effort here, got a goal, so therefore somebody should come and give us a pat on the back. And instead of giving them a pat on the back, Jordan Henderson just strolled up, tucked the ball away, and then all the confidence that we'd spent 60 minutes building up disappeared. And Liverpool took us to the cleaners instead.
Wow, didn't they though? 5-4. As I was kind of hinting before, only four times in the history of football, or the Premier League as we know it, have there been 5-4 results. And Norwich have lost two of them. You've now had 8 goals conceded in your last 2 games. In this match, there were only 12 shots on target. 9 of those were goals, which suggests that neither team were doing anything approximating what you and I might call defending.
Defending, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that Liverpool fans would look at the challenge, the double stupid challenge from Mourinho for our penalty and say that was schoolboyish. I think we would certainly look, first of all, at Russell Martin's insane back pass.
I think that was the turning point.
Well, that was what put us 4-3 down. I mean, by that point, we'd already decided to stop marking and stop playing as a unit. You know those things where they draw lines on the back four and say, well, the back four's in good shape. You can never do that with ours because it's like a stop market graph.
I like when they do it, they take three players and they say it's a triangle, and they do the triangle, and then they move around and it's still a triangle. If you mark 3 points, it's always going to be a triangle, but they still do it.
A really small triangle, yeah. A really narrow triangle. So, yeah, but I mean, we were just a rabble, and I think that's in fact how Alex Neil described it. And I think what for me is really interesting is what is it that's in the mentality of the team that means you can keep doing that. We've done it. So Russell Martin himself has made about 6 game losing errors over the course of the season, and he apparently apologised to the entire team afterwards. And Neil has said, we're past the point of people apologising and moving on. We're at the point of you cannot do this anymore, but yet we still do. Why are these highly paid professionals so fragile? I think you have to say the same about Liverpool as well, who really did look for a large percentage of the time bereft of ideas, enthusiasm, energy. And yet all the stuff I'm reading today is like Klopp's team never say die. It's like, no, you hoisted the ball into our box and we dutifully headed it back across so one of your guys could scuff a shot into the roof of the net. Well,
how did you feel about Firmino? Is he the new Suarez then?
No, but he is a good player.
Right.
I mean, he's got intelligence and he knows, you know, he knows how to find space, and his finishing was cool. But, you know, certainly his second goal, we just left him all alone. And the first goal as well, it was bad defending because Redmond didn't close down the pass to Milner.
But luckily, you have just bought some defenders, one of whom didn't feature in this game, Tim Closer,
who I don't, by all accounts...
Rafa loves him. He says he's good.
But he's not, by all accounts, particularly kind of nimble, huh?
Oh.
And I think that's slightly...
Slow German defender. I can't see any problems with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think our problem is we just get turned all the time, you know? But anyway, I think he will be an improvement, and I look forward to seeing him. And Pinto, our new right-back, got slagged a bit, but I thought he played okay, given the circumstances. But, yeah.
Wow.
But if, I mean, for
so an incandescent mood at Carrow Road after this.
No, bizarrely, I mean, it was me. I would have actually, you know, if you needed a contract killing job after that game, I would have done it. It would have been like a Bourne moment. I would have been able to do whatever and not have to kind of rationalise it with my conscience afterwards, because I just would have been in such a blind rage.
Really?
But a lot of the fans applauded the team off because it was gung-ho, end-to-end, most exciting league
some
in the world.
Some of the goals were cracking as well. I mean, some of the actual goals you scored were really flipping good goals. I mean, you know, you start with the back heel, and I thought Naismith's finish was brilliant. Bassong's goal was an absolute hammer. And I know there were some really great goals scored.
There were some great goals scored, but when, you know, but when Bassong has been just a liability and just undermined all that good work that we'd done, to then hit one from 25 yards for the only time in your career that you're going to do that, and then wheel away like you're Jesus, it's like, no, calm down, mate. And then he's given an interview after the game saying, we need to be men, we're just not enough men, we need to be more men. And it's like, you first.
Stop taking it out on the table.
Sorry.
It's another table you need to worry about, actually. It's the Premier League table. And you're 2 points clear of the drop now. Excuse me. 2 points clear of the drop now. Huh. Newcastle, the team immediately below them. Fortunately for Norwich fans, they went and lost at Watford, ending Watford's four-game losing streak. Below them, you've got Sunderland, who drew at home to Bournemouth. Benikophobe with more of those goal things that he does. That's 2-2.
And diving header this time as well.
Yeah, impressive.
Yeah, that game sort of went pretty much as predicted, in that Bournemouth just tore into Sunderland from the get-go, scored another early goal, their eighth in inside 15 minutes this season. And Benikophobe looks like a natural fit in the Premier League so far.
Bournemouth
were very unlucky not to lose that game. Bournemouth were very unlucky not to win that game. Ah. I think Sunderland got out of jail taking a point from them.
Right. West Brom took on Aston Villa, who remain bottom of the table, still 10 points from safety, but their unbeaten streak continues. And also, they've kept clean sheets now in two of their last three Premier League matches. But that's easy, of course, when you're facing a team that doesn't have a single shot on goal. Yes, West Brom. That's four times this season that they have failed to... basically put it in.
I mean, I think he'll keep them. I think he'll probably keep them up, but I don't. I think the gloss has come off the Pulis way of behaving this season a little bit.
Really?
I really don't.
They are in 14th place. They are 7 points clear of the drop. Only 1 point above them are Everton, who got beaten by Swansea. Swansea, who were roared up to a full 4 points off the bottom, off the bottom three. So yeah, Everton, Swansea. This was the early game on Sunday. And that fellow, Guidolin, eh? Fantastic. Brilliantly coaches Stones into making that funny square ball. And
yeah.
Swansea romped to a second straight win.
Well, Stones is, you know, he's always going to be good for a bit of an error like that. I don't think Tim Howard helped him particularly by being a bit slow out to get the ball. But Stones does have this habit of sort of playing the ball across his own penalty. Or, you know, not rather... and just whack it into row Z. He tries to play it out of the fence, which, you know, is to be lauded in a young player.
Yeah, but and that wasn't out. That was back towards goal.
Well...
which is kind of the first thing you're ever taught to avoid. But anyway.
Yeah, but it's something he doesn't tend to avoid. And, you know, he's going to come a cropper from time to time. And that was certainly one of those occasions. I mean, I was curious to see how Swansea would line up under Guidolin, but he, you know, he didn't play a back three or anything. I was really impressed, actually, with Gylfi Sigurdsson's penalty, which I think was one of the best penalties I've ever seen.
Why?
Well, he rifled it into the top left-hand corner, and it was curling away from the keeper, so it was basically unsavable. But the... obviously, you know, we did our little feature on penalties years ago.
We did, didn't we?
That expert in Austria. And he, as I recall, said that aiming for the top corner is, you know, the highest risk. But if you are on target, highest dividend, because the keeper just cannot save it. And if you're curling it away from the keeper, then even if he gets a hand to it, he's still going to put it in.
Apparently Swansea had never beaten Everton before. 21 attempts in the... I guess that's a Premier League stat, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That result is bad news for the teams in the bottom three as well, because it means Swansea have put more distance between them and the thick black line.
Well, maybe there's some reinforcements on the way in the shape of Everton and Crystal Palace, who are down that way.
There could be. I mean, Everton are...
Ian Mack calling them, they're so close to being a really good football team and yet so very, very far away.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that they play lovely football and they look like they've got all the components, and yet week after week they fail to actually get anything from it. Only Sunderland and Villa have less points at home than Everton this season. Everton have also conceded the most goals at home. Swansea, as we mentioned, four points behind Everton now. And Gwydlin even speaking English post-game. Yeah. Is that a surprise for you, Paul?
Not necessarily, because he's had this sabbatical, he's taken time out, and you know, and that was one of the things he talked about doing, was going and learning a little bit of English. He's one of those managers who you really you sort of wish well for, because he did a remarkable job at Udinese, as you know. You know, he kept dealing with a situation where the whole model of the club involved new players every year, constant turnover, and yet he put them not only, you know, mixing it with the big boys, but fourth and third in successive seasons. If it wasn't for the losing the coefficient, they would have been in the Champions League group stage. And there was an interview he gave a little while ago where he was talking about why he'd sort of taken the time off. And he just said after they lost the second time in the playoff, which was on a penalty shootout to Sporting Braga, he just said, when Mike Aswell missed that penalty, it broke me. Like, I couldn't handle it anymore, basically. And you saw it in his last season at Udinese. But I think he's a good manager, and I think he's a good guy, and I really wish well for him on this one. I remember
that penalty. It was the very antithesis of the Gylfi Sigurdsson penalty. I saw a failed Panenka.
Well, that's it for this bit of Football Weekly. Of course, we've got two games still to talk about. One involving arguably the goal of the season. The other one either bringing to an end, or probably not, Louis van Gaal's reign at Man United.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
That's so right, listeners. What are we going to start with? Old Trafford?
Nah.
Or Selhurst Park?
Selhurst
Is it Selhurst Park? Callum Bradkey wants us to list reasons why Tottenham can win the league. So, well, first of all, Arsenal. Secondly,
Manchester United.
Thirdly, consistency.
All right.
They do have they're not perhaps capable as yet of playing at the same level as, say, Manchester City or Arsenal on a really good day.
Mm.
But they do tend to hit the same or similar marks each week, performance-wise.
Very nice.
Would be one point I make.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're obviously a well-managed team. They've got, I believe it's the tightest defence in the league this season. I think that the way that that partnership has come together at the back with Vertonghen and Alderweireld has really tightened things up. Dele Alli, obviously, actually, I'm going off the highlights for this game, but I'm speaking to people who saw the full game. Actually, it sounds like it wasn't his brightest performance, Dele Alli, but if he can, in not that bright performance, pull out a goal that is, as you alluded to a second ago, quite possibly the best we've seen in the entire league this season, then, you know, they've got that mix. They've got a well-structured, well-put-together team that plays for each other, and they've got a few players like that who can do things that are remarkable. Eric Lamella can do things that are remarkable. Harry Kane, we know, can score goals. I think they've got a really...
Christian Eriksen.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah. Again, Eriksen's been let's out go of back. Form for... I mean, Eriksen looks like he's coming back into form, but he's been out of form perhaps the entirety of the season compared to the last couple of years.
Right. Dele Alli, though. Wow. The most exciting young English player since who? When was the...
Harry Kane.
Gazza? You're saying Gazza, are you?
Yeah. I think he is. I think he's got the lot.
Yeah.
Sorry, are we saying the best young English player or the most exciting?
The biggest prospect, I guess, is what I'm suggesting. Because Ross Barkley would be the last player who people were saying this kind of thing, but Dele Alli feels a little bit more real.
We talked about this last time I was on the pod, and I got a lot of slating from Everton. Well, not a lot of slating, a bit of discussion from Everton fans who said I was harsh on Barkley. But it wasn't so much I meant to be harsh on Barkley, just so much I think Alli has got everything that is required to cut it at elite Champions League level week in, week out.
He doesn't seem to have faced a test that he hasn't passed with flying colours yet.
No, and it's still his first season. You know, he will probably peak, he will probably plateau or have a slip. But
There's a good story in Mike Calvin's book, Living on the Volcano, where he's interviewing Carl Robinson at MK Dons, I think last season or the season before, and Carl Robinson calls Dele Alli over just to introduce him to Mike Calvin, because Calvin, I think, has heard all about him. And Dele Alli's chewing gum, and for his party piece, he spits the gum out of his mouth onto one foot, onto the other, onto his knee, onto his other knee, back up in the air, and back into his mouth, which, apart from the fact that it's very unhygienic, is quite impressive.
It's Mesut Ozil, that.
Yeah?
That's Mesut Ozil's big party trick. He's got a new one where he does that, and then he bangs it to the camera lens. I don't know if it's trickery, but yes. Yeah. But no, he's, I mean, let's talk about the goal then. No chewing gum involved.
Well, I'm going to incur the wrath of Spurs fans here. I don't think it was as good as some people are making out. It was a very good goal, but I think that the absolutely hapless efforts of Emil Jedinak and Scott Dann to prevent it going into the goal made it look a little better than it was. Wow. But his touch was remarkable. And turn, swivel, and shot into the corner. But I do think Jedinak and Scott Dann need to take a look at themselves.
Wow.
For a 19-year-old to light up a match with a goal of that quality, it's worth the admission price alone. And I'm sure Manchester United fans will be absolutely thrilled.
There are those who would say, Barry, it wasn't even goal of the weekend. People who've seen a PSG's extraordinary 5-1 defeat of Angers, the team who were lying in third place, who've been pretty stingy at the back until this game, they got hammered for five. Three of the goals are absolutely exceptional. There is, you know, there's a nice little compile of them out on Twitter, which I gave a nudge to earlier. If you haven't seen them, have a look. Di Maria scoring two of them. One of them is a no-look volley from miles out, which is just ridiculous. But the team goal that Gregory van der Veel, have you seen that?
I haven't seen that one, no. I just
that's
seen
pretty
goals.
Amazing as well. Starts off with a couple of bits of Ibra-ness, and then it just goes all over the place and then in. But yeah.
I did feel that if you're comparing directly the Di Maria and the Dele Alli, Di Maria's is probably better because of the no-look thing, but he did have a large space to aim at, would be the only thing that you might say.
The goal.
Yeah.
Right.
So, well, he wasn't being closed down.
Oh, I see.
In the same way that Dele Alli was.
Okay.
Dele Alli's was just a tap in face. But that game, actually, for the second time in a row, Crystal Palace actually played quite well and still lost.
Mm.
And they've now gone six league games without any of their own players scoring.
Wow.
Because their only goal in those games came from Jan Vertonghen, who, and this would be a worry for Spurs, went off with what looks suspiciously like it could be a long-term knee injury.
Ooh.
After being elbowed in the face by Conor Wickham, who I would say is facing a spell on the sidelines.
Really?
Once that gets retrospectively looked at and punished.
Mm, that could have a big impact on Spurs, who are, as things stand, 5 points clear of Man United, safely tucked in the top four. They're in fourth spot. As you mentioned, Vertonghen's own goal actually seeing Palace take the lead in this game. But Spurs are the comeback kings. Statisticians reveal that they have won 14 points from losing position to the Premier League this season, more than any other team, and certainly more than Everton, who are the team who regularly bung games.
I think that was something I was almost wanted to say off the back of what we were saying earlier. I think another thing to admire about Tottenham is their resilience. They seem to have this in them. I mean, having said that, this particular game this weekend, I think that Palace very nearly got back in front when it got back to 1-1. They had a fantastic save from Lloris, who's also a massive part of why they're doing so well this season. He's a fantastic goalkeeper. I think it was... Jedinak was one of them. Jedinak and someone else, two players hit the bar within the space of seconds of each other, and I can't remember who the second one was.
Tim Sherwood was talking about terrific Tottenham defending, and effectively what we were seeing was terrific defending from the crossbar.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tottenham did defend well in other instances, but yes, at 1-1 the game could easily have broken a different way, and that would have changed everything. Obviously.
But I guess that's football, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
Now, Man United Southampton. Charlie Austin, 7 minutes 43 seconds after coming on. Wham! Scores on his debut. Who knows what impact this could have on Man United's season, and particularly the man sitting on the bench for them. When it was Charlie Austin scored, did you not think, well, duh, why did nobody else come in for Charlie Austin? 4 million Southampton got him
for. Because he's 100 grand a week, isn't he?
Is he that much?
It's loads and loads of money.
But if he keeps you up, that's money well spent.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I think it might bust people. You have, obviously, knock-on effects if you pay that much money to one player.
Is there an issue about clubs not bothering to look at kind of championship players. Benfica Fofana goes into Bournemouth. He scored in his first two. Igalo, how many goals he scored this season?
Yeah, Igalo only sort of joined the championship, you know, for one season last season. Fofana is, you know, he was in Arsenal's youth team up until 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I think players, I saw that talking point or whatever. And it's
well, Louis Taylor was making the point. Yeah, Ross McCormack, 17 goals in 31 for Fulham. Could he not?
He'd be all right. But, you know, if you look at Lee Tomlin at Bournemouth, who was somebody who was doing not entirely dissimilar job, number 10, right, sort of support striker, he looks completely out of his depth in the Prem. I think Chris Martin, who is an ex-Norwich player who I like, he's a good centre-forward in the Championship, scores, got great goal-scoring record there for Derby last couple of seasons. But is he tall enough, mobile enough, strong enough for the Premier League? You'd have to ask questions. But I do think that more comprehensive scouting of lower leagues would benefit teams in the long run. You know, Sam Byron being another good buy for West Ham.
Southampton, anyway, three wins in a row. They haven't conceded a single goal in those three games. Man United, once again, only the one shot on target. And I don't know. I mean, Van Gaal, what's going to happen? All the papers today seem to think that that's it, that he might quit.
Yeah, he might quit. He might get fired. I can't see him being there beyond the end of the season. I can't really see the point in sacking him, because, you know, who do you get in? Do you give the job to Giggs on an interim basis? He's supposed
Giggs
to,
with Sir Alex as a kind of mentor.
Well, Giggs is supposed
Sir Alex,
to just
yeah, I mean, Sir Alex at the end of the season would be nice, wouldn't it?
You know, when your team's style of play has become a national laughing stock, and one of the most interesting things to happen during their match is a mouse running on the pitch and then running off the pitch again. Something has gone badly, badly wrong. But who knows? I mean, walking off, being booed off as he walk, makes that long, lonely walk down the touchline at the end of the game by whatever 40, 30,000, however many were left in the stadium at that point, having just lost to a team managed by a man he really hates, must have been a career low ebb for Louis van Gaal, you'd imagine. You know, so much so that I almost felt sorry for him, you know. But it's just not working for him there, is it? And I'm all for managers being given a chance, but they don't get them in this day and age. And if he does get fired, he'll be well reimbursed.
Man United fans might feel he has had his chance. He's had a lot of money to spend. He's had a significant amount of time in the job. There's
well, define
no
a significant
team.
Amount of time, you know.
It's a season and a half.
Yeah.
But when you're not seeing any sign, it's not as if they're playing well but losing. They're I mean,
well, in this day and age, and it's a damning indictment on the state of the game, a season and a half is a significant chunk of time, and things aren't working for him. There's no sign of them improving.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to compare him to Pochettino in this case, haven't you, and see what the difference he's made to Spurs in a season and a half.
Yeah, fair enough. So who do you think's dropping out of the top four to make room for
Man United? I'm not saying... in the past, I would say...
But that's the thing. It's not just they've got 5 points. They've got four good teams ahead of them.
Yeah. I mean, I'd still, just because of experience, I'd still say that it would be Leicester. But and there's still 15 games to go. But United are not in good form, and Leicester are.
All right. We're going to have another little break, and then we'll be back with other business.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Any other business includes this week, excitingly, League Cup semi-finals. Liverpool are facing Stoke. They have a one-goal lead, which, given the way they defended against Norwich, may not be that reassuring a margin, methinks. On Tuesday, this game.
Yeah, I think Stoke possibly had one eye on this game over the weekend because... I'm not sure if it was down to injury or just resting players, but Bojan started on the bench and Arnautovic didn't feature at all. They've been two of Stoke's better players this season, if not their best. So, and a team like Stoke, their fans would be absolutely thrilled to bits to win the Capital One Cup, I'd imagine, more so than possibly fans of certain other teams who tend to take success for granted. And they deserve a day out in Wembley and a trophy because they're among the best fans in the Premier League, apart from when they're booing Aaron Ramsey.
Did you know only Aston Villa score less than Stoke?
I didn't, but I'll take your word for it.
The other semi-final sees Man City host Everton. Should be thrills galore in that one. What do you think, Paolo?
It'd be goals, the way Sergio, well, assuming he starts him, it's the way Sergio Aguero is playing at the moment. And with everything that we've already said in this podcast about Everton's defending, yeah, should be goals.
Well, though, Everton won the first leg, didn't they?
Yeah, all the more reason that City need to score goals.
That's very true. There's cup action going on in Italy too, isn't there? And such a romantic fixture as Alessandria take on Milan. And that's where are they going to play that at the Juventus Stadium or is it the Stadio Olimpico? They're playing it in Turin because their own ground only takes about six people. They're down in the third division, bless. You wouldn't rule out them getting a result in this game because Milan are, well...
Well, there's a historical precedent, which is that the last time Alessandria got to this stage of the tournament, which is a very, very long time ago, I think it's like 80 years, they did beat Milan. So there's that little lingering precedent. But yeah, Milan aren't playing great at the moment. They're not as disastrous as I think has sometimes been made out. They are still within touching distance of the European places and the Champions League places. But they... Champions League's probably overstretching it, to be honest with you. But they... the performances have been up and down. And what's been strange with Milan, actually, is they've almost tended to produce their best this season in the games where it's like, you know, you have to win or that's it. And you're playing someone good, like against Roma. They came up with a decent performance, got a draw away from home. I'm trying to think what it was they played in the game right after that. And they got a win, Fiorentina. They've dug out some good performances in those games. And they've actually tended to drop points against the lesser teams. In fact, that was a real point for Mihailović, which everyone was beginning to just say, oh, he's doing an okay job just before Christmas because they won a couple of games in a row. And then the next three games were against the bottom three teams in the league and they didn't get... I can't remember if they won the third one. They certainly didn't win either the first two of those games. Right.
And the other semi-final, Paul...
Yeah, what? Sorry.
Yeah, the other semi-final is cracking fixture. Juventus taking on Inter on the Wednesday. So
they're both doing well, those teams in Italy this season.
Well, Inter not so much. Dropping points again. They drew with relegation threatened and newly promoted, indeed, Carpi. A goal scored by our friend Kevin Lasagna, his very first goal in Serie A. And that was very exciting on the weekend. But Juve are doing well. They've now won 11 games in a row. Right, yeah. They beat Roma in a pretty disappointing match. Although, you know, Juve looked in control. There's only one really special moment, and it's when Pogba put the ball through for... If you were one of these massively rich clubs and you were going to buy a Juve player, which one would you buy, Pogba or Dybala?
Well, you know, Dybala's... It's such a small body of evidence for him so far. You know, we think just last summer when they were mooting this... mooting this possible transfer, and Zamparini, the Palermo owner, was saying it's going to cost €40 million, which is what it will cost if all the bonuses get triggered. And Dybala himself is saying, I'm not worth that. Like, I'm not this player that you're billing me to be. But he's been phenomenal the last 2 months, really, since Allegri has allowed him to start every week. Yeah. So at the beginning of the season, Allegri was very cautious with him. And that goal he scored against Roma, I actually really thought that the Roma were played it well in the end. I thought they were going to get the point, which would have been a decent result for them, the way that they've been playing recently, suffocating a Juventus team that's on fire. And it was just so... There was so much subtlety in it. Right from the beginning of the move, he plays this quick ball back to Khedira as he's steaming forward from midfield. He immediately turns and gets away from his man, and then when the ball comes to him in the box, he wants to hit it on his left foot, but he just takes this quickest of touches with his right foot to put the ball ahead of himself, and before Chesney's really got his body in position for where he wants to be to set himself up block off the goal, he just gets it across his own body and across the keeper's body into the far corner. He's a really smart player, and he's a really fascinating player because he's not just that goal scorer either, even though he is now.
Loads of assists.
Yeah, he's getting assists, but it's not just sort of an accidental, you know, he's putting himself in the box and doing the layoffs. He's dropping deep and putting himself in that, you know, in the tre quarti. He's sitting there in the space behind the attack when he wants to go and get the ball and build play. He's an intelligent player, and he's a definitely an incredibly deft and skillful player. I think he's going to be quite special.
Two questions. Michele Martinelli says, why can't Dzeko score anymore? Because that, with his performance yesterday, that is now three goals, only one from open play in 17 matches. And the other one is, so now you've got Juve and Napoli going clear, kind of, ahead of Fiorentina at the top of the table. 2 points between Napoli and Juve. Can Napoli hang on against this juggernaut Juventus?
Can they? Yes. Will they? Is you know, I think they're going to be subject, as these things always are, to fate and fortune, whether the right people stay healthy. I think that Napoli, in my opinion, still play the best football at their best in Serie A, I think their squad is thinner. I think they are more reliant than Juventus are on certain individuals, and if those things start to, you know, the wrong injury at the wrong time could undermine them more easily. They have also got the tougher second half of the season. They've still got to go away to Juventus. Juventus have played basically all of the big teams away from home, and they've got them all coming back to Turin, where they don't drop a lot of points. But I think the Dzeko question, I mean, he's looked just very sluggish to me in Serie A. He looks heavy-footed and leaden. I know that James...
When you're slow in Serie A.
I know that James Horncastle with you on the European Football Show mentioned this yesterday, and I thought it was a good point, that the wingers they have at Roma are... they're not wingers who put crosses in so much. They're wingers who like to bring the ball in themselves and cut in from the wing, both Salah and, when he's been playing, Jovinho. And I think that affects him as well, because what Dzeko does best a lot of the time is get on the end of crosses, and they haven't done that as much for him as they could at Roma. But he's been dreadful, is the short answer with right. Dzeko.
I noticed there was speculation this morning that Roma are trying to get rid of Gervinho.
Gervinho, yeah. Well, I think they might have successfully done that.
Yeah, to China.
Yes.
And Dzeko's not scoring, so who is scoring for them?
Well, Gervinho was one of the ones who was scoring for them. Gervinho and Salah have been scoring their goals. Miralem Pjanic has been scoring goals for them. Really, the lack of goals from centre-forward is a two and a bit year-long problem for Roma now. It's that was exactly why it was a big deal to sign him, was that they were supposed to be fixing this problem.
Although Gervinho doing one might open the door, it supposedly will open the door for Stephen Olcharawy to come. Although he's not the most consistent of goal scorers. Let's finish off today's pod with Charlton Athletic. A 1-1 draw for them this weekend. Jose Riga in his, I believe, second game in charge. It still leaves them 4 points off safety there in the championship, but producer Pete is a Charlton Athletic fan, and he felt that Jose Riga's probably about the best of the available options when Roland Duchelet and his people decided to make another change. But what he was also saying was that the latest measures of resistance by, you know, fellow Attic fans down there, that they're doing, have you seen this flash protest? I know that you're very interested in the whole kind of philosophy of how a supporter should protest against the direction his club is taking. What they're doing, flash protests, which they announced the day of the game to reduce the club's ability to actually react to them. For example, this time the ban was on buying anything from the club, any club merchandise, food or drink, but they waited till the day of the game so that the club would already have got all the food and drink in and then just didn't buy any of it, because that apparently hits them right where it hurts. This is CARD, Coalition Against Roland Duchelet. Apparently our last Charlton chat, which featured a person talking about Charlton who actually knew what he was talking about, made it all the way to Charlton Live, the, of course, infamous Charlton podcast hosted by Luis Mendes. And who knows if this particular segment will...
I have a feeling it may not.
May not do. All right, then. Just here. This is an exclusive.
Sorry,
then, listeners.
Sprung... Producer Peter sprung this.
Well, he sprung it on me, but I was heartened here as, you know, a follower of their travails against their, you know, evil Belgian overlords. Tony Watt's come back because Cardiff have got a transfer bug and they couldn't sign him, so he's returned from his loan there in Wales, and apparently he played well, I am informed, in this 1-1 draw with Blackburn. I've run out of Charlton facts.
Speaking of evil overlords, yep. Actually, you know, Cardiff City overlord Vincent Tan.
Yes.
The sort of Bond villain caricature.
I thought he was a misunderstood and cruelly caricatured Cardiff owner.
Well, possibly, but... on our radio station yesterday, our radio show yesterday, Max and I had Danny Gabadon on as a guest, former West Ham Hammer of the Year, and he, former Cardiff City player. And there was a stage where Danny was made caretaker manager of Cardiff, for, or interim manager or something, while they were between whoever. And Vincent Tan's right-hand man called him into a room one day and told him that, you know, because he would never hear from Vincent Tan directly. It would always come through this emissary who possibly, you know, had
a
razor sharp bowler hat or something, or metal teeth. But from on high came the instruction that Danny Gabadon was to tell his goalkeepers to practice scoring from kickouts, because he'd seen someone do that in a game and decided this was going to be a new tactic for Cardiff City.
Well, that worked out well for them.
But then Gabadon had to instruct his goalkeepers, you know, said this is what Mr. Tan wants right. you to do.
Just kick the ball very, very long.
Yeah, as hard as you can and try and score. Mm. That, and
they were obviously blue sky thinking.
Highly amused.
Mm. That's enough of news of that. That's it indeed for today's Football Weekly. It's ever so many thanks to guest producer Pete and to Paul McInnes.
Thanks and goodbye.
Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
And to Barry Glendinning.
Thanks.
We will be returning on Thursday. Looking forward to another round of this Premier League. And also...
Is there a round of Premier League?
Oh, no. We won't be looking for it. Yeah, absolutely. It's fourth round of FA Cup, isn't it?
Yes. I'm off to Oxford. They're playing Blackburn.
Oh. Do you like Oxford, Barry?
Well, it's that classic Oxbridge thing. I've been in Oxford or Cambridge, but I'm not for a weekend.
Now, they're quite close to each other.
So but I can't remember which one it was. I'm pretty sure it was Cambridge.
Well, best of luck with that, Barry. Although I imagine we might speak before you make that long trip to... No, you're not in on Thursday.
No.
Right. Well, I'll be here, you know, everything notwithstanding. And hopefully you will be too, listeners. For now, many thanks and ta-ta.